Greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. We have a tremendous amount of stuff to get to today, and I have been working pretty much all day to get all this stuff put together, so let's get to it. I've got a wonderfully pixelated screen, unfortunately, but that's not overly relevant. Want to start off just mentioning yet another example of the discrimination, bigotry, and bias of the tolerance police. The firing of Fire Chief Kelvin, which is an interesting name for someone who is in fire stuff, Kelvin Cochran, a Christian man who wrote a book, and this is the big thing he did. It's on Christian morality, and it quoted from Romans 1, and that's not allowed. That's discrimination. That's bigotry. So much for religious freedom. So much for the founders. So much for all that stuff. In our society today, if you're going to hold any position of responsibility, you must bow and kiss the ring of the LGBT community. You have all rights. You must be celebrated. We are wrong for holding to biblical morality. I mean, that's what you got to do. That's what you got to do. If this isn't reversed, then folks, it's over with. This is just going to keep happening and happening. And this is exactly what they want. They want to marginalize. And then they use that as an argument. Well, look at all the scientists that agree with us. There's nobody. It's an amazing thing. And, Here's the horrific thing. Less than half a page in a 160-page book. Uncleanness. He's describing uncleanness. Whatever is opposite of purity, including sodomy, homosexuality, lesbianism, pederasty, bestiality, and other forms of sexual perversion. Wow. That's just historical Christian belief. You can't hold that anymore. No. You're a bigot. You're discriminating if you hold that view. That's all there is to it. They won't debate it, but they will demand it. Then it says, naked men refused, and obviously naked men means Adam was naked before God because he was morally pure and so on and so forth. Naked men refused to give in, so they pursue... naked men refused to give in. Okay, maybe it's not what I thought it was. Anyways... Naked men refuse to give in, say, pursue sexual fulfillment through multiple partners with the opposite sex, the same sex, and sex outside of marriage, and many other vile, vulgar, and inappropriate ways which defile their body, temple, and dishonor God. So it covers the whole range, but because it mentioned the one that shall not be mentioned, the one that has Uber rights, the one that has entire groups that will absolutely blackmail a corporation, a politician. This is what they live for. It's all they live for. It defines their essence. If that isn't enough to show you that there's something completely wrong and unnatural about this, I don't know what it is. Certainly hope and pray that this will be reversed, but I doubt it. We've gone past the tipping point. And that's just the way it works. Did you notice very quickly... Peter Enns. Ah, yes, Peter Enns. People were wringing their hands. Oh, what's going to happen to Christian scholarship if we fire Peter Enns? Well, he's turned out to be the loopy heretic that we thought he was. And guess what he's done now? He here's what he said. He's weighed in on the Kurt Eichenwald article. Kurt Eichenwald's Christmas missive in Newsweek, The Bible, So Misunderstood as a Sin, has predictably gotten its share of strong reactions. As others have pointed out, Eichenwald's rhetoric is inflammatory, his grasp of the issues is secondhand, at points rather naive, at least in the point of view of those who have been around the block a few times on the issues he raises, and especially those who work with the Bible for a living. Duh. But he's still basically right. So he says. He's still basically right. There's old Pete Enns for you. You enjoy it out there in La La Liberal Land, Pete. It's hasta la vista. See you later. Everyone, of course, is talking today about what happened yesterday in Paris. And there are just so many things. Policemen without guns. The proper term for a policeman without a gun is called a target. Oh, the stupidity of I don't know. The newspaper was vile. Is vile. The cartoons aren't even hardly cartoons. They're just, there are some good satirical cartoonists out there. These weren't even good. These were just vile. These were just, how far can we push? I saw one yesterday attacking the Trinity in vile sexual ways. I mean, these were nasty people. But it doesn't change the reality of what we see here. This group did not fear having a bunch of Christians running through the front door with guns, shooting them up, yelling, "Hallelujah, praise Jesus." They didn't have that fear. And they did not fear a bunch of Jewish people running in, doing the same thing, shouting, well, "Hallelujah" would work there too, I suppose. Whatever. That was not their fear. They had one fear, and it turned out to be the one that was the proper fear, which they obviously had not dealt with in any meaningful fashion, and that is people running through the front door of the AK-47s yelling "Allahu Akbar." Now, once again, I heard Shepard Smith on Fox saying that anybody who would call these people Muslims is way out in left field. I can guarantee you they call themselves Muslims. I know what he's saying. He's recognizing that there are all sorts of Muslims in the world that are embarrassed by this and find it to be absolutely reprehensible, and they throw up their hands in frustration, and I understand that. Sadly, there are a lot of other Muslims in the world that, while they would never do it themselves, are glad somebody else is doing it. So, once again, we face the real problem with modern Islam. And it, my friends, is an inherent problem. And when I say my friends, I'm talking about my Muslim friends. Some of whom I am way behind on email correspondence with. I'm sorry. My wife can send me emails and not get responses quickly. So it's just what happens when you don't have a secretary and things like that. You just get behind on stuff. But to you, my Muslim correspondents and friends and debate partners and so on and so forth, I've been talking about this for a while. And I have to think that some of you are hearing, maybe a couple of you will actually try to hear what I'm saying. I understand that the vast majority of you are repulsed by these men and what they've done. And I understand the arguments that are being made. I saw a post yesterday from Yasser Qadhi just pouring out his frustration at this kind of behavior and activity. Okay, I hear you. I got you. But why does it keep happening? Well, it's a lack of education. And there's these young men, and they're running off, and they're taking, you know, this little thing here and that little thing there, and they run off. Okay, but why is that not something that happens with believing Christians? Why is there such a huge difference? Some of you have actually tried to say, well, actually, Muslims are only responsible for a small percentage. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Any meaningful collation in the numbers, 98% of it comes from Islam. And sadly, at least 90% of the victims are Muslims. That alone should be resulting in significantly more. I mean, it wasn't the case in this instance. Well, I've heard it's possible that some of the police might have been Muslim. They had very Muslim-sounding names. So who knows? Who knows? But at least 90% of the carnage being wrought by Muslims today in the world is on other Muslims, which is a tremendous tragedy, and I would think would result in significantly more conversation on the subject than what we hear, but that's the way it is. But guys, do you all sit back in your more... When you're not doing dawah, and there aren't any Christians listening, and you're just talking amongst yourselves, do you sit there and go, wow, why does our religion result in all this? Why does this happen all the time? Why are there so many people killing other people while shouting our slogans? Why is it that they were bowing in prayer next to us and we didn't see this coming? They were next, their prayer rug was next to mine. They went to the same mosques. They heard they heard the same presentations from the same imams, the same sermons. Do you all sit around and maybe in your more quiet moments at least think about that? May I suggest once again what I think the problem really is? There was a time when Christianity, as it's viewed historically, not what I would call true Christianity, but there was a time when there was such thing as Christian sacralism. It was the church, the state church, the church and the state intertwined. And as I understand Sharia, that is pretty difficult to avoid for you. In fact, you can't. It's definitional. It was never definitional for Christianity. Never. I'm sorry, you cannot go to the New Testament text and come up with a state church. You can't do it. And every time we've had it, it's been a mess. It has been an absolute, unequivocal mess. The reason for that is that a state church requires Christianity to be something that can be passed down genetically over time. That you can be born into Christianity. And you are born into Islam. In the vast majority of Islamic nations, you're born that nation, you're a Muslim. Which is why you can have the laws that you have against leaving Islam. And through infant baptism, people were taught that they entered into the church and into relationship with God by something that happened that was totally separate from their own act of will. And the result was you had massive nominalism. People who are Christian in name only. And people who are Christian in name only will use that name to do all sorts of things. And you just look at the Crusades and you look at, they're going over to ostensibly free Jerusalem and we'll hang a left and sack Constantinople while we're at it, from which Constantinople never really recovered. And all the rest of that kind of stuff. And we had that phase. When I say we, I'm speaking very generally there. I don't recognize that movement as a specifically biblical or Christian movement. But Christianity, biblical Christianity, recognizes there's no such thing as a genetic passing on of the Christian faith. When we talk about a person confessing faith in Christ, we recognize there are false professors. There were false professors in the New Testament period. The apostles had to deal with false professors. But conversion in the Christian faith is a life-changing thing. It is a dying to self It is a dying to your own dreams and desires and a submission of all that you are to the lordship of Jesus Christ. Jesus himself said in the Gospel of Mark, if any of you would come after me, you must deny yourselves and take up your cross and follow me. You, as a Muslim, would never believe he could have said that because you deny the cross anyways, but he did say that. And everyone knew what he meant. To take up the cross was to join the death march. To be willing to undergo public humiliating execution. The worst death possible. And that's what Jesus told the crowds. If you want to be an eye disciple, that's what you must do. And that's why he could say that anyone who would love father or mother, or sister, or brother, or child, anything in this world more than me, not worthy of me. Why? Because if you've died to all of that, so you can only live to him, that's a radical thing. And biblically, we must call our own children to repentance and faith. That's why I resist all of those systems that assume regeneration on the part of children so that you do not call them to repentance and faith in Jesus Christ, no matter what form that might take. And so it's a radical, radical thing to be a true follower of Jesus Christ and nominal Christianity. I think you Muslims can recognize nominal Christianity. You know the difference between someone who truly believes, who makes their life decisions in light of the lordship of Christ. You know the difference between them and the folks just go through the motions. Just like there's an obvious difference between a real believing Muslim and the many, many, many nominal Muslims that fill the streets of Muslim nations. But the problem is, how do you become a Muslim? Because you don't believe in original sin. You don't believe in the fallen nature of man. You don't believe in the need of a mediator. Because of these things, you become a Muslim by saying, La ilaha illallah wa Muhammadan Rasulallah, with the seven proper conditions and so on and so forth, but it's just a matter of saying the words. And I continue to find a tremendous hesitance on the part of Muslims, even Muslims that are really disgusted about what's going on, a tremendous hesitance to identify as non-Muslims. People who engage in these types of activities because they've said the Shahada. You know, as a Christian, I am given a standard, and I can go to the New Testament, and someone, you know, 1 John says, those who are born of God do not love sin. They do not continue in the practice of sin. And so someone who's running around lopping people's heads off, I've got really good grounds saying, that is not a Christian. What ground do you have to say, that is not a Muslim? Where you go? It's frustrating to me that I don't hear more discussion of this amongst my very serious-minded Muslim friends. And maybe it's just because you don't want to have that conversation in front of us. Okay, I get that. But I'd like to see some evidence that it's taking place anyways. Because as much as I want to try to keep telling people that the vast majority of Muslims don't want to kill you, they keep seeing this stuff. And they see these people, and you saw the video. Looked like a police officer shot him down the street. He's moaning and groaning, and they come right up near him and shoot him again. Right at Point blank range. And, you know, the guy wasn't even armed. And it's pretty hard to get around the savagery that Islam is producing in these people. Now you say, oh, no, it's not Islam that's producing this. Well, if you don't believe in original sin, what is it? I mean, I understand what it is. These are unregenerate individuals who don't know God, and they're using a religion as the excuse for the expression of their unregenerate nature. I can say that as a Christian. What's your excuse? What's your answer? What's your explanation? I just don't think that Islamic anthropology, Quranic anthropology, can explain this, especially when you look at the war is the prophet, from your language, from your perspective. I certainly don't believe he was a prophet. But that's the name of a book. And you look at what he did. And there's some real violent stuff in there. In there. Yeah, there is. There is. So I think there is, you know, every month, and really every week, but pretty much every month these days brings a big worldwide recognized thing that makes us once again go, well, it seems that these are Muslims doing these things, huh? Why? Raises the question yet once again. One last thing before I go into an explanation of something, show a video, and then we're going to be joined a little bit later on by the famous Turretin fan. I suppose I should fire up, actually, where did it go? Oh, it is there. Huh. Yes, sir. What are you
doing that? I'm getting complaints.
I don't care about complaints. Y'all, look. I don't want to have to look up into super bright lights. Okay? That's just all there is to it. I don't want to go blind while doing this. It makes it very difficult to see the screens. So I don't care. Just, you know, it doesn't have to, you know, be perfect like that. As long as it's viewable, you know, let's just go with it, shall we? Okay.
Without blinding you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Okay. One last thing before, like I said, the infamous Turretin fan is going to be joining me. We're going to be starting to talk about Devin Rose's book. Because, by the way, I should let you know that on this coming Saturday, Lord willing, I will be debating Mr. Rose, who is a convert to Roman Catholicism, on the Up for Debate program, 8 a.m. Central Standard Time on the Moody radio network. That's the same program that Michael Brown was on with Matthew Vines, if you recall. And we are going to be debating, can a Roman Catholic be an evangelical? And obviously, if you want to redefine evangelical and take out the evangel, but hopefully the issue will allow us to actually focus upon what the gospel actually is and the vast difference between a gospel that includes an imperfect, incomplete sacrifice of Christ that perfects no one. Priests who are called Alter Christus, a place called purgatory, something called indulgences, venial sins and mortal sins, and so on and so forth, that does not constitute the biblical evangel. And hence, you cannot be an evangelical if you do not hold to the biblical evangel. So that's this Saturday, and Turretin fan's going to join me here in a while after we do this next segment to talk about Mr. Rose's book, which he wrote a tremendous review of, posted yesterday morning. But for the last program, I was informed, I hadn't seen this, but got something in the mail without a note. It is a it's a shot glass, and I'll put it up here. It says drunk ex-pastors, and it says drunkexpastors.com on it. And it's a shot glass for drinking alcoholic beverages, obviously. Now, I'm not a teetotaler, but I don't drink alcohol. I don't drink alcohol because I cannot stand the taste of alcohol. And it seems that even when you're trying to mask it, it does funny things with my heart rate issue. So it's a no-go for lots of different perspectives. So I suppose I could put some Hammer Heed or something like that in there, but you normally drink more than that. This, of course, was sent to me by Jason Stellman, who I guess is on the air right now with Mark Shea on his new program on the Immaculate Heart Network, I guess. Anyway, I don't know. I look at that phraseology, drunk ex-pastors. Now, I know that the other of the two, we talked about this briefly, the other of the two, and no, I won't be leaving it in here, is also an ex-pastor who now is an agnostic or atheist or something like that. And, of course, Stellman is ostensibly some kind of Roman Catholic, even though, as he says, it's the worst thing he's ever done, even if it, even if Rome is true, it's still the worst thing he's ever done. Yeah, Turretin fans listening to Jason Stellman on the radio at the same time. Turretin fan is a tremendous multitasker, isn't he? I couldn't do that. While typing, yeah, it's pretty amazing. I don't even know what to say to Jason. Jason, I told you, I told you when we met that you were playing with your soul. And anyone who could have once held a truly reformed understanding of what it means to be a pastor, who could then have a website and a program called Drunk Ex-Pastors. How great is the fall of the one to whom much light was given. How great is the fall. And it just seems the more you do, the more you provide evidence that what all of us have been saying all along was true. I could hope for your repentance, restoration of your family. There'll never be a restoration of your ministry. Not going to happen. But we can hope for the restoration of your family, and certainly hope that you would find your way out of that system that will never ever give you peace. Never ever give you peace. You know it. You knew it when you were in that room, right through that wall. But anyway, there you go. Now, the next thing I am going to try to do, and notice I said I am going to try to do, this is fascinating. You should have a QuickTime player feed coming in. Okay. At some point, I think yesterday, in a conversation with someone on Twitter, I was asked if I had read or I had watched the new Sam Gipp video. You may remember I had responded to the first four with videos of my own. The fifth one I skipped because there just wasn't anything in it worth responding to. It just, it really was not worth even putting a response up to. And I had heard a sixth one had come out. I hadn't taken the time to look and see it. So somebody asked me about it, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I forgot to do that. So I looked it up and I started watching it. I started shaking my head and going, all right, okay. I'll do it. Because you see, last week, one of the topics that I wanted to get to, but decided not to do it because it has taken a lot of time to prepare for it. And part of that was because I wanted to use Keynote to use it, and Keynote just refused to cooperate with me, as I'll show you in a moment. I was going to address the issue of who killed Goliath when you look at the comparison of 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 5, and 2 Samuel 21, 19. Why was I going to look at that? Because Eichenwald raised it as a contradiction in the Bible. And I was going to include it in my response. And when I started thinking through how much material I would have to cover and how I could cover it in a webcast, I said, forget it. Well, lo and behold, guess what one of the central parts of this video from Sam Gipp is? Exact same thing. From a different perspective, obviously. But it's the exact same thing. So in this particular video, again, it's not much of a relevant argument from Gipp, because allegedly what he's dealing with now is, well, the King James has words in italics, as if that's relevant. And he does completely dismiss the idea that the King James corrects the Greek and the Hebrew by saying it's not the original Greek and Hebrew, it's the Greek and Hebrew we have now. Well, that's the whole point. Remember, I sat in the exact same studio. He was not any farther away from me than Rich is from me right now through that window when Sam Gipp himself looked into a camera in response to John Ankerberg asking him, if I'm in Russia, do I have to learn English to have the Word of God in my own language today? He said, God has promised us only one infallible and inerrant translation in one language at one time, and right now it is the King James Version of the Bible. So, whatever else you say, that seems to indicate the radical idea that the King James corrects the Greek and the Hebrew. Trying to get around that by saying, well, no, it wouldn't correct the original Greek and Hebrew. Just the Greek and Hebrew we have today is not changing anything. It's still saying that the King James translation is the standard, and that the Greek and Hebrew which we have today, from which the King James was translated, should be corrected to whatever the King James itself says. So anyways, let's take a look at what Gipp says. And then we are going to look at the Hebrew, and we are going to look at a very difficult textual issue in Hebrew. For those of you listening via podcast on audio, you're probably going to have to look at this in video, because I'm going to be showing it on the screen. I'm going to be talking about it. What? What's the date? I don't know what the date is. I guess it's Thursday the 11th, I guess. If they're listening to it, it's right there in their podcast. Why should I repeat that? That's silly. Anyway, Rich just wandered off for a few seconds there. all right, so let's take a look at what Sam Gipp said. And this will help us to understand why we need to address this particular subject.
So, question. Who killed Goliath?
David.
You think?
Yeah.
You really believe that? Because I believe it. Okay. Well, one of the classics and one of the most devastating things that happens to modern translations is pulling those italics out. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 21. And look at verse 19.
And there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanan, the son of Jeroboam, a Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam.
All right. Now, what do you notice about the brother of?
It's in italics.
Okay. You know, modern translations take those words out because they're in italics. But here in the ESV, it says this, Elhanan, the son of Jeroboam, the Bethlehemite, struck down Goliath the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. So they took the italicized words out, and by doing that, they inserted a double problem. Have you ever heard anybody say this, lost people say this? Well, the Bible has contradictions in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, the King James Bible doesn't have contradictions in it, but modern ones do. You were told that David killed Goliath. Well, you were told David killed Goliath because in 1 Samuel chapter 17, it says David killed Goliath. And in the ESV, in 1 Samuel 17, it says David killed Goliath. But then you get to 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 19, it says Elhanan killed Goliath. That's a contradiction. But it doesn't put a contradiction in the Bible. It puts two contradictions in the Bible. Go to 1 Chronicles chapter 20. And 1 Chronicles chapter 20 is a parallel to what you just read. In other words, it's just a second accounting of that battle. And look at verse 5.
And there was war again with the Philistines, and Elhanan, the son of Jair, slew Lahmi, the brother of Goliath the Gittite, whose spear staff was like a weaver's beam.
In this ESV, this English Standard Version, it has two contradictions. It says David killed Goliath and Elhanan killed Goliath. Then it says, it's a contradiction, it says Elhanan killed Goliath, and it says Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath in the same battle at the same time, double contradiction. It's kind of like this, I got a little story coloring book for one of my grandkids. This coloring book has a mistake in it. It says, David threw a stone and hit Goliath right in the forehead. But we know from the ESV that it wasn't David. It was Elhanan. And I think this, if they can scratch words out of the Bible and put different words in, I guess I can correct a coloring book.
Okay, so there you go. There's your discussion. And notice he just described as scratching words out of the Bible. Well, is that what's going on? Well, we need to take a look at it. And we need to take a look at it in the original language in which it was written. So I have put together, now again, I wanted to have a real nice, pretty graphic here. But let me tell you something. Keynote and PowerPoint and programs like that do not like Hebrew. They do not want to work with Hebrew. They do not like the fact that Hebrew goes from right to left instead of left to right. And they don't like final forms. And they just really, maybe there are specifically Hebrew versions out there someplace. I don't know. But so what I did is I just dumped it into a standard standard text file here. And it's nice and big, pretty easy to see, I think. It's pixelated on my side, but that's life. Hopefully it won't be on your side. And here we have the two texts. 2 Samuel 21:19, 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 5. Now, let's read the New American Standard at 2 Samuel 21:19. It says, there was war with the Philistines again at Gob, and Elhanan, the son of Jair Oregim, keep that in mind, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Then we look at the parallel text to that. In 1 Chronicles 25, it says, and there was war with the Philistines again, and Elhanan, the son of Jair, killed Lahmi, the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Well, they sound almost alike, but there's a real difference between the two. Now, what the King James has done, and someone this morning in channel put a reference, a link to the original, I guess the original 1611 is available online, so you can look at it. And it had the brother of in a font completely other than the Gothic font that was used for the rest of the text. In fact, it looked like our modern fonts. It almost looked like a plain old Times Roman or something. But that was how they did italics, evidently, at the time. And so from the beginning, the King James translators have recognized that there is no the brother of in the Hebrew, and that they are providing it. Now, did the King James translators know about this issue between 2 Samuel 21:19 and 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5? Probably. Did they know about the most probable explanation of it, which I'm going to provide to you here in a moment? Brilliant men, maybe they did. Maybe they did. I don't have commentary from them to give you that information, but maybe they did. I agree with the interpretation that lies behind the rendering in 2 Samuel 21:19. When you have parallel texts, you have to allow them to speak. I mean, I've pointed this out. Not only do you have parallels, you have parallels, for example, in between Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Very important to bring the parallels in. There are obviously parallels here between Samuel and Chronicles. Obviously, the studies of the Synoptic Gospels. That's the primary issue you're dealing with. But even in books like Ephesians and Colossians, it's important to bring the Colossian parallel into Ephesians and vice versa. There's reasons for that that we could discuss. But when you have more than one rendering of a story, of a narrative, something, it is always good to allow the light from the one to shine on the other and vice versa. And given that 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, is in perfect harmony with the entire narrative that has already been given, and only 2 Samuel 21:19 is out of that harmony of the narrative, then we have to ask ourselves a question. Is there a reasonable, fair understanding of how someone at some point in time could have miscopied what was originally found in 2 Samuel 21:19 into the form that we have today? Now let me show you. Let me see if I can bring this up. I don't know if I can. That's interesting. It's not showing it. Let's see if it shows it now. There you go. Bring that up. All right. Here is one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Isaiah scroll. And let me zoom in here and then move around a little bit. You will notice, especially along seams, you have places like right here. Look at that word right there. Right here, you have smudging. You have darkening of the material there. You have darkening over here. I mean, these scrolls are in excellent, excellent shape, but not all scrolls were in excellent shape. And you can see here how some, like right here, it's gotten into the writing at this point, this is just a part of dealing with ancient writing materials and things like that. That's just something that you're dealing with. And so the question is there a way of looking at these two texts in Hebrew that would explain how 2 Samuel 21:19 arose from the text of 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5? Because 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5 is in harmony with the entire full narrative of what happened in regards to David and Goliath. Because, see, what Gip is doing is he's taking the easy way out, and my concern here is this. What Gip is doing is once again hamstringing any meaningful apologetic defense for the inspiration and even preservation of the Bible. Because he is locating the authority for this reading between 1604 and 1611. And other than a very small little group of wild-eyed fanatics, that's not going to fly in doing meaningful apologetics. I mean, you know, if you want to sit there and say, well, yeah, you know, but the Bible was re-inspired between 1604 and 16. It needed to be re-inspired? Really? Did the authors say they were re-inspiring? I mean, it only works in a monologue in very small independent fundamentalist Baptist churches in certain areas. It just doesn't work anyplace else. So is there a way to understand what happened here? Well, this is one of the toughest things I've ever tried to explain on the dividing line, because the vast majority of my audience does not read Hebrew. I will be outlining what I'm talking about. I'll try to explain it as best I can. Sometimes serious apologetics is not using the easiest argument. Sometimes there are easier ways of doing it. I don't know of any easier way that is defensible and consistent than to look at this right now. So let's take a look at it. Let's go to this screen, full screen. Thank you. All right, so what we're saying is this is the true text and would have been the text that was originally also in 2 Samuel 21:19. So when we look at the differences, there are primarily three differences, and we can understand on the basis of difficulties of sight. You could have had damage to the manuscript. You could have had bad penmanship. You could have had bad eyesight. Certainly as I get older, I certainly recognize that. My arms aren't nearly long enough anymore. There's all sorts of issues that could come up here to where this becomes the foundation of the Masoretic reading in the Hebrew here. The first is that the sign of the direct object, which in Chronicles comes just before Lami. So right here, here's what is being referred to. These two letters right here, Eth. This is the sign of the direct object. And what would the direct object be in here? Well, this is where Elhanan killed who? Well, the brother of Goliath, the Gittite. So here is the direct object, Lami, and what is happening is that the copyist mistook this word right here for either BT, I'll use English equivalents here, or BYT, or this, it becomes this word right here. You can see similarity between this and this. And hence you end up with Baith right before Ha-Lami. And if you put it together, it's Baith Lahami, which becomes Bethlehemite. Bethlehem, house of bread. And so instead of the direct object and then the man's name, you end up with Bethlehemite. That's the first misreading. Then, the copyist misread the word for brother, Here's brother in 1 Chronicles as the sign of the direct object, which is what he's already confused beforehand, right before Goliath. So this becomes this. There's the sign of the direct object. There's Goliath. So by putting the direct object right before Goliath, Goliath now becomes the direct object of the verb, which is to kill. So now you have a guy, and it's interesting, his name, you'll notice his name in the New American Standard. Let me get back to Elhanan, the son of Ja'ar Oregim. Ja'ar Oregim. Ja'ar Oregim would actually mean the son of the forest of weavers. The forest of weavers is what Ja'ar Oregim means. It doesn't make any sense. Now you notice Oregim is also, we need to keep the Hebrew up there. They don't need to see me. We'll just keep this up. Here is Oregim in 1 Chronicles. It's at the end. A weaver's beam. But it's been moved up to here in 2 Samuel. I'll talk about that in just a moment. So what you've got is, here you've got the direct object. Now it's Goliath. Instead of brother of Goliath, becomes Goliath. That's how Goliath becomes the direct object of killed. And then you have the copyist misplacing the word for weavers so as to put it right after Elhanan. And so you have Elhanan, son of, and then you get Ja'ar Oregim, forest of weavers, which makes no sense. The weavers belongs here, shaft of weavers, down at the bottom of 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5. So, we can see that by seeing how this and this were misread by the, which are in their right places, make perfect sense in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, but they don't make much sense here, we can see how the corruption in the Masoretic text took place. And because we have preserved for us the parallel in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, and, of course, we have the entire story given to us elsewhere in the scriptures, then we can recognize what happened in regards to the original reading of 2 Samuel 21:19. So, there we go. All right, now, you might go, well, that still bothers me. I'm sorry. I realize that it would be much simpler, safer, to just go, don't worry about it. God re-inspired the Bible in 1611, and that's all you need. For a lot of folks, that's more comforting. They forget that we're talking about a handwritten text that has been transmitted to us over the course of what? 2,700 years or so at this particular point? And that we have so few places like this that we even have to look at this is the actual amazing part, not the other way around. I mean, for the vast majority, well, there aren't almost any written texts. I mean, we have written texts from clay tablets from that far back, but we hardly have almost any copies to where we would even be able to start doing textual criticism on those things. There's just almost nothing that has the kind of textual history that the Old Testament texts have. I don't think that the reconstruction that I just provided to you is outlandish. It's not begging the question. The forms, the words are similar. It's very easy to understand in light of a damaged manuscript or just simply carelessness on the mind, on the part of the individual, to see how this could have happened. And in light of the parallel, that is what happened. But when you take the Sam Gipp approach, you might say, well, you get to the same thing, because what you're saying is Elhanan killed Goliath's brother. Yes, he did. He did kill Goliath's brother. But when you come to that conclusion based upon an interpretive line inserted in italics in an English translation, and then you invest that insertion with divine inspiration rather than doing the work you need to do, which the King James translators may have done. But the point is, you need to know this part. You need to know the tough part. You end up destroying any foundation for someone to be able to meaningfully defend their faith against a very hostile world today. Now you might say, I could never repeat that. Well, okay. But at least you know there's an answer for it and you could dig it out. I mean, Archer has it in his Encyclopedia Bible Difficulties. It's found in various commentaries. You'll find a discussion of it. You could direct people to it. At least know the parallel in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5. It's good to know that there is that parallel passage there. But the fact of the matter is, I do not believe it's honoring to God's truth to take what we might call the easy way out. Especially because, fundamentally, when you get down the road, that's going to end up completely handicapping you in being able to give a meaningful response and defense of your faith. So, there you go. That may be one of the more challenging things you ever tried to do on the dividing line before, but it's what we do, and hopefully it was helpful to you. All right. I've pretty much broken this up into half-hour segments. Pretty much. That's pretty good. We still have half an hour to go. We're not. We're doing a jumbo edition today. And so what we're going to do now is yesterday, Turretin Fan posted a very lengthy review of Devin Rose's book, The Protestant's Dilemma. And I played for you at the end of the last program a portion of Devin Rose's video that had been directed to, which is what sort of brought all this about. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, on Saturday morning, and I said earlier it was the 11th, it's just the light in my watch, it is Thursday the 8th. Okay, that's the date today. So on the 10th of January 2015, if you want to go back into the archives. What?
Do you remember a number of years ago, a fellow from Texas called you up and said that he had arranged a debate between whatever Protestant you could find and Scott Hahn?
Yeah.
And you told the fellow he needed to call Scott back and
get an answer from him? No, I told him that I'd be happy to engage in the debate, but that I had a feeling that Scott Hahn would not, and the next day he called back and very apologetically had to withdraw his invitation for me to come because Hahn's statement to him was, if White's there, I am not.
Moody Radio called about 25 minutes ago, and the phrase is, from Devin Rose, I will not go on the air with James White.
So what are they going to do?
They've asked that you give them a call after our show is over. They are, this, as she put it, put her in a very difficult spot at the moment as to what to do, but he made it clear that he will not go on the air with you.
Wow.
Since you were announcing that,
this is the same guy.
Figured I'd throw a stick in his folks.
This is the same guy that wants to debate the canon.
Yeah, but not with you.
No. That's what he said. He said he wants to debate the canon.
All I know is what she said, and the quote is, "He will not go on if you are on with him." That is the quote.
Let me put Turretin Fan on the air here. Are you with me, Turretin Fan?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. So what are you doing Saturday morning, Turretin?
I think it would be quite shocking if you'd agree as well. Not Dr. White, but Turretin Fan. Usually there's even more excuses made that, you know, I don't have a name, and there's an anonymous person and so forth. And I understand some of that concern, but I would be very surprised. I have a feeling he just doesn't really want to engage in a serious debate. But I'm happy to, you know, you're welcome to offer that.
Okay. All right. I will, because it's an important subject. It does need to be addressed. And I would simply say I have proven over 25 years of debating that I can engage in scholarly, respectful debates. I don't think that Devin Rose has proven that, has he?
I'm not aware of that.
Yeah.
I've seen him contribute a few things in blog comment boxes over the years, and his book reflects that he's followed this call to Communion's website.
Right.
But I don't know of any debates he's done or really any kind of serious engagement with scholarly work on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there certainly isn't any of that in his book. So how fascinating. Did he not think that Moody would go find someone who might actually be able to respond to him? Or was he, I guess he was hoping for some kind of, you know, liberal that might go, well, yeah, you know, we can all just have a, but his book is not promoting a liberal perspective. It's a pretty old style Catholicism that he's putting out with infallible popes and everything else. So I don't know why he would expect. I don't know. I'm. When do they call? 3:37. Okay, so only 25 minutes ago. Okay, well, certainly puts a different spin on our conversation here, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And of course, if they want me to come on and role play him, I could read parts of his book to you on Saturday morning. There's some remarkable claims, things that I can't imagine too many kind of scholarly Roman Catholic folk arguing, like the idea that Protestants think that the Pope had authority and lost it somewhere along the line.
Right, right. Yeah, there's some pretty amazing stuff. Well, let's go ahead and get started on this. Whether he scuttles our encounter set for Saturday or not, doesn't change the fact that the book is out there, and the book is published by Catholic Answers Press. I can remember the day when Catholic Answers was quoting Yves Congar and people like that, but it seems they've fallen on hard times, especially because they're not only doing this, but they're also doing stuff with people like Dave Armstrong as well. It almost seems to me like they're wanting to really become much more of a populist rather than a, well, have they ever really been, you know, overly frontline in their approach, I guess. I don't know. I've been reading them since the late 1980s, and they have put out articles that were on this level before, so I guess we shouldn't be overly shocked. But the point is, the book's going to be getting a some level of play on that level. So it is worthwhile responding to, because we will be talking to many Roman Catholics who will adopt these perspectives because, let's face it, they're easier to enunciate than a lot of the more nuanced material put out by some of the, some of the Call to Communion articles. They're just difficult for people to even get through without falling asleep. So it's also hard to then try to repeat it in any type of thing like that. So let's take a look at it. Your article is very fascinatingly titled "Review of Devin Rose's The Protestant's Dilemma," and this is available. I'm looking at it in Evernote. If they just put in Turret and Fan and Devin Rose, that'll probably come up, right?
I think so. It should come up.
Okay. Just on a general basis, let's talk a little bit about the format of the book. Describe it for us.
There's a foreword. An anonymous foreword. I don't know who wrote it. It's phrased in the third person as though it's by someone else. I'm not sure who it's by, actually written by. And that kind of talks about this need for dialogue, which in one sense I'm glad for. I think it's good when Roman Catholics will talk to us, so otherwise there's no way for us to discuss these issues. And the fact that he calls for dialogue in the front of his book and then if this turns out that he ducks out on the debate, that's kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
But then proceeds to a brief introduction, which is sort of autobiographical, talking about his personal encounters, and then breaks out after that into 34 points that he, on the video, I think, calls them arguments. They're various topics, kind of loosely arranged into a number of different four heads. The first of those, he titles it Divine Authority, and then under each of the arguments, he actually makes if Protestantism is true, then this thing follows.
Right.
And that's then halfway through the chapter, he has because Catholicism is true, and then something that follows. I decided when I was reviewing this to kind of focus more on the if Protestantism is true side, rather than the because Catholicism is true side, simply because in the vast majority of the cases, it's pretty quickly resolved that essentially his premise is flawed.
Right.
If it's okay to jump into the first one.
Yeah, before we dive into that, I just wanted to mention that what struck me, and I've not finished all of it yet, I got through a big portion yesterday, and then trying to get ready for that David and Goliath thing took most of my time today. But what really surprised me, because I've finished all the section on authority and I've moved into other areas, is in the video he presents this as destroying my book, Scripture Alone. And so I expected numerous citations, footnotes, and an interaction, especially with my presentation of the canon as an artifact of revelation, canon 1, canon 2, canon 1 being that known by God as a result of his act of inspiration, canon 2 being the derivative knowledge of God's act of inspiration on the part of the church, and the relationship of inspiration to all of this, and all that kind of stuff. I get the book. I got it here on those watching my Kindle Voyage. Very, very nice unit. Let me just mention by that. And I look through all the notes, and I'm not referenced even once. And I get through the entire section on Sola Scriptura, Deuterocanonicals, all the rest of that kind of stuff. I've done multiple debates with multiple Roman Catholic apologists on the apocryphal books at Boston College with Gary Machuta. Not a single reference, no interaction whatsoever with my presentation on the issue of the canon. He focused solely on R.C. Sproul's phrase, fallible listing of infallible books, and one quotation from Calvin, but never dealt with my presentation whatsoever. So in his video, he faults me for not responding to his arguments in a book that was written 10 years before his. But then I get his book, which allegedly destroys mine, and there's no interaction, not even seemingly a recognition of what my arguments in my book, written 10 years before his, actually were. And I was just left going, what is going on here? Maybe that explains why he doesn't want to debate, because he doesn't want to have to explain why that is. I don't know, but I was shocked at that fact, because obviously I picked up the book thinking, okay, you know, here's going to be somebody who has, you know, interacted, and that's not what I got. That's not what I got at all. So I just wanted to point that out, that it's very, very interesting. So let's go ahead and dive into point number one.
So his first, right out of the gate, this is how he chooses to set the tone. If Protestantism is true, Christ revoked the authority that he gave to the church when he founded it. Now, that's not a premise that I can... There may be some Protestant somewhere. There's so many Protestants. But that's not what Reformed churches teach, and it's certainly not what Protestantism as a whole teaches,
that
Christ revoked the authority he gave to the church. Well, I mean, a big part of it is we don't think that Christ gave the authority that he, meaning Devin, thinks that Christ gave.
And in the form that he thinks it was given, in the idea of a monarchical episcopate and all the rest of that kind of stuff. A meaningful argument would have to first establish the Roman Catholic concept of authority from some type of meaningful source, either from a citation of a series of scriptures, meaningful exegesis, history, etc., etc. But yeah, presuppositionally, he simply presents the Roman Catholic perspective and then expects us to formulate our theological paradigms in light of accepting, or at least in light of, the Roman Catholic position.
Yes, and his choice of text to establish his position was rather strange. In this particular case, he goes to Matthew 10:1 and talks about how the 12 had authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every infirmity, which isn't the most obvious place to go for talking about church authority.
No.
Especially when the popes don't heal diseases or infirmities or cast out demons.
Oh, well, now remember, Pope John Paul II has been sainted because some nun someplace prayed to him and got healed. So, you know, maybe... Okay, never mind. I'm sorry. I just mentioned that in passing.
The whole process by which that happens is something that people should actually pay attention to. I mean, the process involves them explicitly praying to God to take action, not on the merits of Christ, but on the merits of this person.
Right.
And if the prayer comes true, then it's taken that that the person's merits are sufficient to qualify them as being saint. That's kind of the procedure that's followed, and it's an example of not praying through Christ, but praying through another intercessor rather than praying through Christ. And it really should be shocking, and it should be obviously wrong to people who are familiar with the Bible and realize this is, we're always encouraged when we pray through the intercession of anyone that it's through Christ's intercession.
Right. Obviously, they get around that by saying, well, of course, anybody who is a saint is because of what Christ has done, and so it's just a secondary way of getting around it, but it's rather obvious how that actually functions. So, if Protestantism is true, Christ revoked the authority that he gave the church when he founded it, and of course, the reality is, if he were accurately representing the Protestant position, is that the argument is on the nature of not only the ecclesiastical structure, but the relationship between scriptural authority and ecclesiastical authority, what is an infallible authority versus a fallible authority, et cetera, et cetera. But he doesn't start where he needs to start. He starts assuming the end of the argument, and then the rest becomes rather circular at that point.
Yes, and the idea that the way he summarizes it is that the authority must have been lost when the visible church became morally and doctrinally corrupt. And that way of looking at it will tend to make people, you know, if someone starts looking at it that way, that the church had this great authority and right. just lost it because it corrupted, then you can kind of see where he goes in part of the rest of the chapter, where he tries to say, well, it may be hard to pick out when it is. Is it Trent? Is it some other time? And that, you know, I can understand if you start going down that road, but that isn't the strongest. It's not the correct way of looking at it. And there's a difference between having some authority and having no authority. I mean, we wouldn't, if you were a Christian and you live, you know, in the late 1400s, you have a church authority over you, even if that church is very corrupt, and even if there's good reasons why you should not have communion with the people who are in charge of the church. If you're in that church, there's an authority system in place. It may be unbiblical in many ways, but it may be corrupt in many ways, but it doesn't mean that there's no authority at all. It's just the whole trying to create a dilemma where there isn't one is the theme of the book, obviously.
Well, and I think what it also completely ignores is he doesn't seem to recognize his own debt in the modern period to the development hypothesis and the popularity of the development hypothesis. And if he were to be honest about what Newman himself recognized, then the issue is, what is legitimate development and upon what basis can development take place, and what is illegitimate development? And obviously, many people have argued that if you look at, for example, the first ecumenical council, which at the time nobody knew was an ecumenical council, and that is only looked back upon as an ecumenical council in light of later definitions, that there was nobody there who held dogmatically to the things that Devin Rose would hold dogmatically to as a Roman Catholic today as absolutely necessary to the very definition of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so what is the foundation for this development? What is the nature of this development? I just didn't see any evidence of any meaningful understanding on his part of that aspect that even Roman Catholic historians take as a given.
Yeah, that it's really we see that in the example of the papacy. There are some that's his second topic. There are some Roman Catholic apologists out there who are very dogmatic at the papacy from the beginning, but. And there may even be some Roman Catholic historians that try to make an argument that it was from the beginning.
Right.
But increasingly, we find frank admissions from Roman Catholic historians that it wasn't from the beginning. And then they try, as you pointed out, to appeal to some kind of development hypothesis or, you know, seed to the acorn to the oak tree type right. of thing. And say some, I think Sullivan may be an example, basically says it developed, but that's God's providence that it developed, therefore it's from God. But that's a completely different position than the idea that Christ instituted the papacy and Peter was the first pope.
Which is not only the obvious teaching of the papacy, at least for the past 200 years, and is absolutely necessary for even understanding Vatican I and the concept of infallibility. I mean, it's just basically stated in infallible documents, even though you have to wonder today exactly where the current pope is on some of these things. But it is obviously the historic perspective for the past number of hundreds of years, but that requires a foundation of certainty that many in Roman Catholicism just simply don't have today. And I think one of the things that strikes me as interesting about Devin Rose's book is that it seems so out of step with where Rome is today. And when I say today, within just the past number of months, because of the obvious realization on the part of so many people that we currently have two living popes, and the differences between the two are painfully obvious. No one, I think, can ever imagine Ratzinger saying to someone about homosexuality, "Who am I to judge?" Okay? I mean, there's no way that the Pope who put out the Papal Syllabus of Errors would ever have said, "Who am I to judge?" He would have said, "I am the one to judge." But now we've got a Pope who says, "Who am I to judge?" And I know, the conservative can go, "Well, that wasn't an infallible statement," and blah, 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 blah. But they're having to do so much of that today that this kind of old-style, triumphalistic, we just take ourselves as granted as the 2,000-year-old church perspective. I know these folks are still out there. They always have been. But it just clangs in light of what's going on with Francis and the situation in the Roman Catholic Church today.
Yeah, the traditionalist Roman Catholics, of course, the Sede Vacantists think, you know, are just crazy about this development because it just proves them right that these increasingly liberal popes and their papacies are coming. So that proves them right in their view. The very traditionalist folks, though, are just really not happy. I posted to my own blog a video from this Remnant Forum. Michael Madd and Christopher Ferrara, who you debated, I think, Ferrara
yes.
recently.
Yeah, I remember we did a program afterwards where we talked about his faux Augustine quote.
Yeah. He was bemoaning this, and I think it was either he or his co-host who actually said that they thought that Francis is worse than Alexander VI, the Borgia pope, who really thought that he's much worse and much more dangerous, and that they're just hoping that the cardinals can somehow rope him in and prevent him from doing the damage that he has the power to do.
Yeah, these are not good days for Catholic apologists, especially when they're running from... Moody Bible Institute now. That's pretty fascinating. I'll find out more about that here in just a little while. Okay, argument number two. We have a couple of minutes here. We can at least cover argument number two. If Protestantism is true, after centuries of its existence, God decided to eradicate the office of the papacy. Now, when I first started reading your review, I'm like, wait a minute. At least Jerry Matitix and Patrick Madrid and these guys, at least they recognized the necessity of actually having to give some kind of a meaningful argument first. You know, I mean, I've debated Matitix on the papacy and Pacwa on the papacy, and they all tried to, you know, they didn't just start here, and yet that's what's behind this kind of a statement. And I'm left going, huh? How does that work?
Yeah. The wording that he chose, that after centuries of existence, God decided to eradicate the office of the papacy, I was almost left stuttering. Like, does he seriously think that's what we believe? Does he really think we thought there was a papacy and it got obliterated because of some problems?
Well, there certainly were some problems. I mean, he didn't... I may have missed it, but I haven't heard him so far, and he's already passed in my reading, he's already passed the authority stuff, so maybe it comes later on, but I don't know why it would. But I didn't hear anything about the Avignon papacy, the pornocracy, you know, the stuff that you read in standard historical sources about the role of politics and the emperors in the choosing and selection of popes and things like that. He certainly seems to be aware of at least some of it. I didn't hear any defense of Liberius and the Arianized Sirmium Creed and all sorts of stuff like that. It was just sort of like, we don't have to worry about that. We have this 2,000-year unbroken chain of infallible popes, and you've just got to deal with it. It's almost sort of it's sort of a fantasy view of the church, because... doesn't he realize that there would be all sorts of people at Boston College that would pick this book up and would just start laughing because it doesn't even represent a Catholicism that they could even begin to understand themselves.
I don't know how aware he is of these things. He seems to hang out with this called to communion crowd, which tends to have a more traditional mindset. And it's not really clear how much he gets out. He doesn't seem to be citing a lot of other Roman Catholic sources for his positions. I don't know to what extent he's read them. It just doesn't show up. But, you know, when he says things like the Pope is not needed because Protestants have the Bible, I mean, that's partly true from the standpoint that we have a sufficient authority in the Bible. But also, I mean, more importantly, we don't have the Pope because we have Christ. He's the head of our church.
Right.
That's the fundamental. As far as the papacy goes, we don't need a universal head of the church, not just because we don't need a human teacher that would replace the Bible. And it's interesting that he sees it that way. But it's because we have Christ as our head. He's the only head of the church, and there's no second head. But
even his historical stuff, for example, he says, quote, "The historical fact of the papacy throughout every Christian century makes a compelling case that it was intended to be a perpetual office within the institution that Christ built." Now, there are so many problems with that statement. I mean, if you're talking about a bishop in Rome, first century, he seems to think so. There are elders in the church at Rome, but there's the whole problem of a lack of a monarchical episcopate in Rome up until about 140. And then it's just painfully obvious from any perspective that the power of that office grew in proportion to the denigration of the power of the Caesar in the West, to the point where the center of authority moves to Constantinople, and especially after the fall of Rome in the 5th century. These are just givens in almost any historical survey of the papacy in Roman Catholic schools. It just strikes me that there is this massive chasm between Roman Catholic historians and Roman Catholic apologists, especially this kind of naive apologist as Devin Rose's.
Yeah, it's rather frustrating, and I don't know whether it just tells me what it kind of tells you what Catholic Answers thinks is good quality material,
right?
When this is what they're publishing, it makes me wonder what do they do with their own scholars? There are Roman Catholic scholars that exist. Why is Catholic Answers unable to attract their works, or why are they unwilling to publish their works? Is it because of, you know, their view on social issues? It doesn't line up with what Catholic Answers views as the one true position of Roman Catholicism. What is the reason? Are they too frank? Are they too candid? I think you had some criticism of, let's say, Professor Moss's view of martyrs in the early church.
Right.
May play some kind of games as far as into describing what counts as persecution.
Right.
But, you know, she's a professor of, I think it's, I want to say it's New Testament at Notre Dame. You know, she's in the Roman Catholic scholarly tradition. Maybe she has some problems. Maybe she's too, maybe she plays some games with words.
Right.
But there's a reason that they're never going to publish what she's writing, yep. And that's because what she's writing is the polar opposite of this story. He talks about missing saints towards the end of the book. You know, he wants to color this as, you know, every martyrdom story is true. There's no myths or fables. It's all these are all the way things were, and no hagiography at all. Just historical fact.
Like I said, there's a huge gap between the apologists and the vast majority of the scholars, and that of course destroys his entire "we are all unified, we all believe the same thing, we're all on the same page" argument. So it really causes a problem. Maybe that's why they won't publish that stuff. Well, look, Turretin fan, we will want to continue this in the future with picking up with ecumenical councils. as your schedule allows and as my schedule allows, we'll try to do that. Obviously, I'm heading to Norway in just a couple of days. So, but once we get back, we'll continue this and continue looking at that. Thank you very, very much for joining me today on The Dividing Line.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, sir. God bless.
All right, bye-bye.
All right. We went a little bit over there, but we're going to wrap things up here because I guess I have a phone call to make. So I don't know what's happening Saturday, guys. We'll see. We'll see. I have proven, without a doubt, the ability to engage in meaningful dialogue, even with someone who themselves has not proven it. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Just keep checking the website, see what they have to see, see what's going to happen with it. Don't know when the next Dividing Line is going to be. I'm going to try to do one from the G3 conference at some point. We'll try to make it work with Bodie Balcom or something like that, but we'll see. God bless. Pray for us as we travel. We'll see you next time.